Okay, we are live and we're going to start this in 2 seconds. Well, good evening, everybody. Kufar Akbar. Of course, it is another edition of the Crossing the Crescent Discussion Group. We are live here on Blog Talk Radio every Tuesday evening at 5 p.m. Central Standard Time and Sunday afternoons from 2 p.m. Central Standard Time. We generally go for about 2 hours on Sundays and try to keep it to about an hour and a half on Tuesdays, but sometimes we just can't help ourselves and we go a little bit longer. Tonight, we have a topic that we were trying to continue from Sunday, but I've been watching the chat, and it seems like some of the people that would be most objectionable to this topic or want to input opposing views, perspectives, have kind of bowed out for some reason. So we'll just do the best that we can. I appreciate everybody coming tonight. I have a slideshow that I want to present. So you're going to have to bear with me. It's pretty comprehensive, but I guess I should say what the topic is first, right? That would help. Yeah. All right. So tonight we're going to be talking about, does Israel have a right to the Holy Land? Do they have a right to claim what they have today as their homeland, as their country? And do they have the right to defend it? And if they do have the right to defend it, by which means do they have the right to defend it? So we're going to be getting into some scripture. We're going to be getting into some current events. We're going to be getting into some quasi-legal issues and try to figure out why people so staunchly back the establishment of and preservation of the Jewish people in their homeland in Israel, and why that is not only from a legal perspective important, but also from a religious perspective, why that is important for us to support. So let me get over here. And does anybody have anything they want to chime in with before we get going on this? Because this, like I said, this is going to take me some time here to do this. I still got a little bit of a sniffle.
So my
going
thoughts
on.
After I got a preview of this, and my thoughts are, if you have a child at home and they are taking ninth grade or 10th grade history, social studies, you really would like for them to watch this. This presentation is professional. It's well done. And that's from my perspective as a former social studies teacher.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate that. The thing is that, let me just say this. If you do want a copy of this, all you have to do is just email me at Eric Thekafer, Eric the Kaffer, spelled K-A-F-I-R at gmail.com. And I'll be more than happy to send you a copy of this slideshow. Okay, let's go ahead and get started. I made a mistake. Oops, I didn't mean to do that. I made a mistake already. I made the mistake of letting my cat in right before the show started. He was sitting out here on the windowsill looking at me and meowing. I thought, okay, I'll have some mercy on it because it's pretty cold outside. So I let him in, and now all he's doing is rubbing up against my feet, trying to get me to pet him. Yeah, I don't know if you can hear that, but he's also meowing at me. Okay, so we're going to be talking about Israel and its history and why they have a legal claim to the land and what is being done to keep them from staying in the Holy Land today. And this was one of the topics of contention on Saturday when we started talking about anti-Semitism, when we started talking about the anti-Semitic attacks that had occurred in Texas. What was that, Saturday evening? Has anybody heard if they've captured or what, not what if they captured, but what, why they arrested those two jokers over in England for? Did anybody hear what, why that was?
They had a connection. There was a correlation between the guy they caught here, the guy that did the, that took hostages in mm-hmm. at the synagogue in Texas. Was a British national.
Right.
And he had connections to people over there that they felt were terror related.
Okay. But we don't know the extent of that. Just the fact that there was a relationship between the two of them.
Yes. Okay. And that was enough for them to, apparently they were just looking for a cause.
Okay. Well, I just didn't know if something had come into the news today or popped out in the news today, because I went in and looked and I didn't
anything.
See
anything. I'm watching actually, so I'll let you know when I see it.
Okay. All right. Let's jump back over here to the slideshow. Okay. So when we look at Israel today, we're going to look at who has a right to the Holy Land. What evidence do we have for this, and why is there conflict over this? And as Christians, and I'm assuming everybody here in our well, I don't know everybody, I'm assuming in chat and in on the panel, of course, are Christians. What we can do to support Israel itself. Now, when we look at Israel's possession, not occupation, but possession of their rightful homeland, and you hear the consternation of Muslim majority countries or people of the Islamic faith themselves saying that Israel has no right to that. It's an Islamic land. Well, if you look at the Islamically held lands in that region, and this doesn't even include, if you go up here, I mean, this doesn't include Turkey and doesn't include the stands over here. Here's how much they have. Yeah, it's right there. Just that little sliver right there. But yet this possession of this land by the Jews today drives the entire Islamic world nutso. Now, today that would be kind of an antiquated way to describe it, actually, because the Palestinians, in my opinion, have essentially wore out their welcome in the Arab world or the Muslim world, because they've been offered so many opportunities for autonomy and self-rule, but they keep on blowing it, like, you know, electing terrorist organizations to rule over them. But let's take a look at this from a biblical perspective. Let's start with Abraham and how Abraham was given the land by God. God called him out of the land of Ur and says, I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and I will bless those who bless you. Now, this is in the book of Genesis. And then he establishes a covenant with Abraham. And we all know the story in chapter 15 of the book of Genesis, where he has Abraham come in and sacrifice a heifer, a goat, a ram, turtle dove, pigeons. And then God himself comes in, and he is the one that establishes the covenant. He has Abraham fall into a deep sleep. And in the process, it is God who walks between there, establishing the covenant for himself between him and Abraham. And notice it says here, to your offspring, I give you this land. Well, the question then becomes, who is Abraham's offspring? Well, it says here, to your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. So the question then becomes, is this, somebody was here and popped out. Who is Abraham's offspring? So let's look at Genesis 26:5. 26:5, this pertains to to Isaac. This is specifically pointing out Isaac. This has nothing to do with Ishmael. And if you look down here in verse 4, I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven and will give your offspring all of these lands. Whose offsprings? Isaac's. It is not, this does not mention Ishmael at all. I need to take something off here. Hold on just a second. There, because I want to make sure everybody can see the slides. Everybody knows where the Cross and the Crescent dot. Oh, by the way, go over to crossandthecrescent.com. That is the website that we have. We're going to be doing some upgrades over there, but all of the videos are accessible there. Or, of course, go to Cross and Crescent YouTube channel. Like, subscribe, click the bell, and there was something else that goes with that. Like, subscribe, click the bell. Share. There you go. Share. Okay. So here we have the covenant of God being given to Isaac, not Ishmael. Ishmael was blessed by God, but not the covenant was not passed to him. Now here it is now given from Isaac. It is given to Jacob, not Esau. It is given to Jacob. So here in Genesis 46, 1 through 4, Jacob is given the land. Now look what happens here in 23, chapter 20, I'm sorry, 24, verses 3, 4, and 7. Here you have what we call the Mosaic Covenant. The Mosaic Covenant is passed through Jacob to the 12 tribes of Israel. They're taken into bondage. So there's a 400 period from Jacob to Moses. And now Moses brings them out of the promised land and establishes a new covenant with them in the Sinai. And here in the book of Genesis, you have the covenant being passed from Abraham through Isaac to Jacob. Now it's the Mosaic covenant, which is the 12 tribes. Does this have anything to do with Ishmael? Very no. good. No, it does not. Exactly. And so if you look at here, then he took, look at here. What book did he take? Well, he took the book of the covenant, by goodness. And read it, and hearing the people, he said, all the Lord has spoken, we will do. And that it was the covenant that they made with God. Now, Ishmael was made a promise by God. This is true. He was made a promise, but he was not granted that covenantal relationship that God shares with the Jewish people. And look what he also says, but I will establish my covenant with Isaac, not with you, Ishmael, but with Isaac. So when they say that God, you know, we have a covenantal right to the Holy Land, no, you do not. You do not. If you do, then you're going to have to demonstrate it. And I'm fixing a little Southern lingo for you there. I'm getting ready to show you how even your own book says that you do not have a right to that land. Get to Genesis 25, and it says this is the blessing that God gave to Ishmael. He says, I will give you 12 tribes, 12 sons. 12 sons will make great nations, and there were great nations that came out of that. Now, we don't know if that has anything to do with Muhammad and his lineage, because that lineage itself is just a big hot mess, but let's just forget that little tidbit for right now. Now, let's go to, let me bring this back up here, sorry. Now let's jump over to what the Quran teaches. This is what the Quran teaches. Quran says in chapter 2, verse 20, it says, O children of Israel, remember my favor. I favored you and fulfill your part of the what? Oh, yes. The Quran even says that there was a covenant between God and the Jews. Go to chapter 5, verses 20 through 21. Go into the Holy Land, which God hath ordained for you. So here he's telling the Jews to go into the Holy Land that God has given you. It's kind of funny how the Quran even says the same thing. Go to 5, go to 12. Allah made a covenant with the children of Israel. So even the Quran admits that God made a covenant with the children of Israel. The children of Israel being who? The descendants of Jacob. Jacob's name was changed to Israel after he had that little wrestling WWE match with God. Okay, so let's look at some of the history behind it. So 1400 BC, Joshua claims the Holy Land. Then you have your period of judges for about 300 years, and you have the period of kings, which lasts for about 400 years, maybe 500 years. And then the temple is built in 968. Notice this possession of the Holy Land from 1400 up to the temple being built. And then you have the kingdom becomes divided in 930. And then you have the northern kingdom taken into captivity. And
wait, Eric, what? You mean the furthest mosque was built in 968? The furthest mosque?
No, I don't. I'm going to show you why here in a minute.
Okay, all right.
Just saying. Okay.
This is before Christ, not after Christ.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, I mean, that's what, you know what? Well, I'm not getting into it. BC, BCE, CE, AD, you know, it's just maddening some of the things that you have to, how we address the dates today. But anyway, okay. And then you have the northern kingdoms taken in captivity, and then you have the southern kingdom taken in captivity. The difference is that the southern kingdom returns and the northern kingdom is not. It was called the Babylonian captivity. And this is where you have Ezra and Nehemiah returning to Jerusalem. And keep in mind, during that time period, you know, the Jews had been falling in and out of idolatry from the period of kings and from the period of judges. And you would have, you know, really good kings, but then you would have a lot of bad ones. And they would be marrying into neighboring tribes, trying to establish alliances and things of this nature. And when they did this, they would bring in those foreign gods. And these foreign gods was like adultery to God. So he let them be taken into captivity. Now, notice when they do come back into the Holy Land in Ezra and Nehemiah 536, they rebuild the temple. They restore the walls. They restore the sacrificial system, and they never go back into idolatry again. The problem was is it became way too legalistic.
I just can I point out something here too?
No.
Yes. Okay. Thank
go
you.
Go ahead. All right.
I just want to point out here. Notice they were taken into captivity for idolatry, and they were allowed to return. It's called the righteous remnant. So I just want to point this out on the people. God's wrath rains down on the wicked and on the just at the same time. Because if the righteous remnant were not taken into captivity along with the wicked idolaters, there would be no righteous remnant. I just thought I'd point that out. Just, you know.
Okay. So. Yeah. And this is true. Well, okay. Let me get sidetracked here, but thank you. Yeah. Thanks, Brad, for pointing that out. Okay, then we have Jesus' crucifixion. Then we have the second temple is destroyed. Now, this, you know, what's amazing about this, a lot of people don't realize, is that all the sacrifices that were made after the death of Christ, crucifixion of Christ, were not accepted by God for a 40-year period, for a generation. And then the second temple is finally destroyed.
Wait, I got a comment on that, too. Do you know that story? This is in the Talmud? Okay.
Yes. If you want to explain it, go ahead.
Yeah, so basically, what happened was, okay, the same room that they would have met in, the Sanhedrin that they would have met in, okay, to condemn Jesus, okay, after the crucifixion, it was an earthquake, okay, and the main stone that held the roof up totally completely cracked in half, okay, and destroyed that room. They could no longer meet in that room. Secondly, okay, there's a thing with the, what is it? Oh, I can't think of it now. The color of a thread or the color of a cloth, okay? If the sacrifice was accepted, it would be a certain color, okay? Well, after that day, according to the Talmud, around that time, that sign that the sacrifice was to be accepted was no longer given, okay? I can't think of it. I wish Anthony Rogers were here. He'd tell it better. But basically, I'll have to look it up. I'm sorry to interrupt. I should have had more information looking up. But those are the two things. Those are in the Talmud. Okay.
Yeah, but the fact of the matter is even the Jews recognize exactly. And acknowledge the fact that their sacrifices were not their exactly. They call that holiday. Is it the Day of Atonement?
Day of Atonement.
There you go.
The Shekinah had left the temple.
Yes.
All right. Let's jump back over here. Am I going too fast? Or this is about the right space to skip through all this? All right. Okay. All right. Okay. So then from 70 AD to 1917, you have the diaspora of the Jews. After 70 AD and Hadrian, Hadrian took all the Jews into captivity, dispersed them from their land, and they were not allowed to go back to the land, well, at least during the time period of the Roman Empire. And that diaspora lasted until 1917. Then in 326, you have the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is built there, and you have the establishment essentially of Christianity in the Holy Land. And then in 691, well, actually, we should say in 638, Jerusalem is sacked. I guess I didn't add that little fact in there, under the Caliph Umar. And then in 691, they build the Dome of the Rock. Now, notice, the Dome of the Rock is built in 691. Muhammad had his little night journey on his flying pony in, I think it was 627. I'm willing to be wrong on that date, but the fact of the matter is how can you have, this isn't one of the, why the Quran is anachronistic. How can you have somebody going to the furthest mosque when that mosque doesn't even exist? And we're not even talking about the Al-Alaska Mosque, because the Al-Alaska Mosque, I think that's in here, wasn't built until 705.
Well, it's even better. He was in a dream. How can you know where somebody was in a dream?
It wasn't a dream. He got on a flying donkey, and come on.
Oh, come on. Aisha, the rock all the way there.
Exactly.
Yeah, Aisha even says that he didn't leave. He didn't go nowhere.
That's true.
What is Aisha know? She didn't even know how old she was when Muhammad climbed off
on her. Let's not go there now.
You can't believe the greatest scholar in Islam on these things. Yeah. But no, seriously, you kafir, don't you understand? There is proof. We have proof. You know how we have proof? Because there was a caravan of Arabs coming in, okay, into Mecca at this time. And one of them said they heard that one of the camels had died because they heard a frightening sound in the desert. Well, that was the time that Muhammad was flying around on his winged jackass. Okay? But yeah, and he was holding down the rocks because the rocks wanted to go to heaven with him. And you can actually go right now to the Dome of the Rock, reach your hand in a secret chamber, and touch the rocks and touch the fingerprints of Muhammad. Come on. Come on. Is that not proof?
I want to show something here, because when it talks about the furthest mosque, and fortunately, John Isaac is here tonight. He sent me this link. John, are you there, sir? You sent me this link. So when we start talking about what the furthest mosque was, can you explain this to us?
Because the fact that history confirms that the furthest mosque or Masjid al-Aqsa was built after Muhammad, like 60 years after the death of Muhammad. Then the story in Quran or story in Hadith that Muhammad made Isra to Masjid al-Aqsa doesn't make any sense. Muslim trying to hide this fact by saying, like this is an article, some of Saudi people, especially the lawyers, say that Masjid al-Aqsa or the farthest mosque is just beside Mecca, about 20 kilometers north from Mecca. Not that is in Jerusalem. This is okay. Other thing.
All right. So
that's
if you
let's to hide this error.
Okay. So so when we start talking about the furthest mosque, you're saying that this is a 20-mile walk. I mean, you could walk 20 miles in a day. Well, some of us could, but it doesn't matter. It could in fact be the furthest mosque from Mecca at the time. Now let me ask this. Okay. Was this night journey when Muhammad was this before the Hijra or is this after the Hijra?
No, I think it's after Hijra. I can check the date exactly.
I believe it's post Hijra.
After Hijra, I think.
It's after Hijra?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, he was in Aisha's bed clothing when it happened because she was there. Well, no, we can't believe her. But no, he got up to take a pee or something. I don't know what it was in the middle of the night, but no, that's what happened when he was in Aisha's room. But Aisha said, no, that didn't happen. But what is that silly girl?
The statement is that he was sleeping in bed when he had this imaginary tale.
Right.
So,
yeah. If you're sleeping, again, nobody can know where you are in your dreams, so they can't know that Al-Aqsa belongs there.
Let's make sure we understand why this is important. The reason why this is important is this is why Muslims claim Jerusalem as their third holiest site, is because Muhammad had made this journey to Jerusalem. So just to make sure that how they establish their claim to Jerusalem, so saying this is where Muhammad made his, what is this thing called that he, there's a word for it.
The mirage. Here's, I just want to tell everybody that's listening a funny backstory to this whole thing. Okay, so when Uthman, was it Uthman? Uthman took Jerusalem, right?
Omar
took Jerusalem, sorry. When he showed up, he went to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, where the high priest or bishop was at, and he asked him where was the temple built, okay? Because he didn't even know. Okay, now at this time, here's the funny thing: the Temple Mound was the municipal garbage dump. Why? Because it was a great insult to the Jews to dump garbage on their Temple Mound. Not only that, there was a guy, Constantine's son, Julian the Apostate, who wanted to restore paganism, okay? After Constantine died, he became emperor for a while, and he wanted to reinstore paganism. So the way he thought he could do it was by rebuilding the temple at Jerusalem to prove that that Jesus Christ wasn't real, because the temple's not going to be rebuilt until he returns, okay, according to preterism, according to that, you know, eschatology at the time. So here, this is, seriously, they went to rebuild the temple, earthquakes happened, fires came out from the ground, okay, and it scared all the workers away, and they never, because they couldn't complete it, and he gave up on the project, obviously. But anyway, after that, it became a municipal garbage dump. So this bishop, this Catholic bishop, or maybe it was an Orthodox bishop, said, yeah, you want to go pray over there? Go pray in the garbage dump, dude. So he sent the Muslims to go pray in the garbage dump, man. I mean, seriously. And then they did what they did. Anyway,
if you notice the location of the Dome of the Rock, in the Temple Mount, it sits overlooking the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. The Holy Sepulchre's, well, anyway, in relation to it, sits much lower than the Temple Mount. Itself. So establishing the Dome of the Rock where it is was a way of establishing your dominance as rulers over that region, over that city. Yeah, so if you look where and the thing is that the Dome of the Rock is supposed to be a shrine commemorating the Mirage, the night journey.
Yeah, seriously, they have this enclosed rock, okay? They've got it enclosed. You can go pay it, you know, give a donation of $5, $10, whatever it is. Stick your hand through this curtain and touch the rock and feel the fingerprints of Muhammad, where Muhammad pushed the rocks down because the rocks wanted to go to heaven with him. And he said, no, you cannot go to heaven with me. And he pushed the rocks down. Okay, dude, that is according to Islamic scripture. But one more thing, I'm sorry to take over. I'm sorry to madden the show here on you guys, but here's another little funny piece of information on this. Okay, so they build this thing, but here's the thing. You were mentioned it's built on the high places. What does Daniel say? When you see the abomination that causes desolation sitting on the high places where it does not belong, then you will know.
There we go.
Yep, there you go.
Good old Daniel. Okay, what I was going to say about the Dome of the Rock, though, it was built to commemorate the night journey of Muhammad. The problem is that the original inner and outer ambulatories that are there make no mention of it. It doesn't say anything about his night journey on the original structures. The only thing that says on the inner ambulatories is that say not three. Jesus was only a messenger. He wasn't. So to me, looking at this thing, it's nothing but a shrine to Antichrist, to deny the divinity of Christ.
Yes.
Is what it is. But this isn't this. And here's the thing. This isn't the farthest mosque, though, because the mosque that they're talking about, Al-Aqsa, that John had mentioned, is a mosque that wasn't built until 705. I don't think I have it in my slideshow here, but Al-Aqsa was not built. I don't have it in there. You have the Dome of the Rock being built in 691 by Al-Malik. And I guess he built the Al-Aqsa also, but it wasn't built until 705. So here, again, this is anachronistic. The mosque doesn't exist. It's supposed to be the mosque that Muhammad did, in fact, have his night journey to. It wasn't there. There was nothing there. It was just one big flat temple mount. Okay, so we talked also about the Ottoman Empire being crushed in World War One, and this is what we were talking about on Sunday. You know, if you're going to get in a war with somebody, wars have consequences, and I'm going to show you that here in a second. They lost control of all of their land. They were forced to become secularized. And we also have the Balfour Declaration at this time too. And then in 1920, you have the British Mandate, which is the mandate to rule over that region, and it did not expire until 1948. That's another date that is important to know. And notice what the Balfour Declaration says. It says that they're going to, they understand the sympathy of the Jewish Zionist aspirations, and they favor the establishment in Palestine, a national home for the Jewish people. This is in 1917. So the Balfour Declaration essentially says this is what we plan to do. The problem was, is the Muslims in the region at that time. They were not going to accept even one foot being given to the Jewish people. So what do you have at this time? You have a mass migration of Jews going there and buying up land from the Arabs at highly inflated prices. So when we look at Zionism, Zionism is used as a derogatory term today, when in fact it isn't. It's just this movement to go back for the Jewish people to go back to their homeland. That's all it is.
So exactly.
And people, yeah, you're exactly right. People like to use it as a dirty word. So when we look at the British Mandate initially wanted to give all of this land, which they call the Transjordan, to the Jews. So when you look at the size of that, the sheer size of this, the Arabs are like, of course not. We ain't ever going to allow something like that to happen. So when the Jews are told that, hey, this time is coming where we're going to be giving you back your homeland, they start heading back there. This is after World War One, and they started going back there by the thousands. And as like I said, they were just essentially living out in the middle of nowhere in tents when they got there, and they were buying up the land in what is now Israel. They returned from all over the world, even had newspapers. This is a newspaper that was printed in Palestine, in Israel, Jerusalem, in 1920 here. It was a Jewish newspaper. What is Abbas saying here? Abbas, what is this? Oh, I'm telling propaganda. Well, Mr. Windhill, come on up here.
That the Hebrew word there is Eretz, the land.
There you go.
Yes, truth in history is propaganda now. Okay, yeah. Seriously, go ahead.
Yeah, that's. Yeah, I wonder what. Okay, but and here's what happened that caused all of this. And this people like to discount this and not ever mention this. But the Holocaust, and this is just my opinion, but it's a educated opinion based on history and facts. I want to be careful how I word this. This event is what, let me just put it this way. This event is what enabled the Jews to get back into their homeland. And here's why. If you look at the Holocaust itself and how it all began with, you know, the Treaty of Versailles and Germany being shamed, being forced to pay all these reparations, and the Jews getting blamed for it. Why? Well, because they could only work in institutions like banking and the legal work and things of that nature. They weren't allowed to work in trade unions. So they worked in these financial institutions. So they're blamed for sending all the money out of the country. So when Hitler comes to power in 32, 33, who does he blame? Well, of course, you look at Mein Kampf. He was blaming the Jews and when he wrote Mein Kampf, and he's going to blame the Jews as soon as he gets there. So what does he do? He starts instituting the Nuremberg Laws in 1935. He confiscates their property and moves the Jews to ghettos, which are enclosures where they have no freedoms, takes away their right to own property. And then you have the movement from the ghettos into these concentration camps. And in these concentration camps, this is where they are essentially worked literally to death. And then from the concentration camps, then you have the transportation to these death camps, places like, of course, Auschwitz-Birkenau, Sobibor, Treblinka, all these death camps in that we find in Poland. And there, this is where they develop the gas chambers. And this is where we get the stories of Jews being sent to the gas chambers, millions of them dying in these gas chambers, and their bodies are cremated forever. Then after the liberation, people started realizing the scope of the Holocaust, where you have 6 million, two-thirds of European Jewry are killed in just 4 years, two-thirds. And they start realizing how terrible this was for the Jewish people. And the reason why the Jews got caught in this is, now, of course, the hatred of Hitler for them. The guy's a psychopath. But the fact was is that they didn't have anywhere to go. They had no place to flee to. In the United States, we do not have, we're not innocent in all of this either. There was an entire shipload of Jews that were brought to the United States, and Roosevelt would not allow them to get off that ship. He sent them back to Europe, and just as soon as they got back to Europe, they were put on trains, transported to Auschwitz, and they were all killed. Thousands of them. So we were just, as a nation, you know, we're just as culpable as the rest of the world for that crime. So what does the world do? This world say, well, look, they didn't have anywhere to go. So let's grant them their homeland back. And that's what they did. So the British Mandate ends in 1948. And if you look at the lands here, these lands here, this is what this blue area here is what was allowed to them when they claimed their sovereignty. They partitioned this off for the Jews, and the Arabs rejected just a sliver. Now, remember that picture that I showed you of the Transjordan, how much they were originally supposed to get. And look at this little sliver of land that they're actually getting.
Tiny.
Yeah, and notice this land down here, that's nothing but desert, wasteland. It's nothing down there. So this is all they got.
Yeah, but what do the Jews do with that desert?
We're getting that old. Hold on. So just as soon as they declared their independence, they were attacked by Egypt, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and forces from Saudi Arabia, and they whooped their butts. Now, it took them a year to do that, but they did whoop their butts. Now, when you look at what happened after or during the war, as these Arab countries are coming into Israel, they're telling these Palestinians, quote unquote, get out of the way and go get behind us, and we're going to push these Jews into the sea, and then you can come in and you can take their property. Well, at the end of the war, after losing it, these Palestinians had nowhere to go. Now, they could have been absorbed and assimilated into lands like in Egypt or in Jordan or in Syria, and none of those countries would accept them. Now, again, this was part of a conversation I had with John Isaac today. John?
Yes, sir.
can you come in and explain to us why these countries did not want to take these Palestinians?
Look, as I said from the beginning, and I always say it's a religious problem. no Muslim can accept defeat in front of Jews. They have their own hadith that before last day in last day, they should kill Jews, and even Jews hide the back of rocks or something. The rocks speak or the trees speak. There is Jews here. Then all Muslims have this hadith in their mind. They will not accept leaving any inch for any Jews. If let us say Egypt took the people in Gaza, and let us say Jordan takes the people in West Bank, then there is no Palestine. Then it will be a peace between Arabs or Muslims in general and Israel after defeating the Muslims before. Then this is not accepted by Muslims, and it is not political issue, it is religious issue.
Okay, so in other words, they're using the Palestinians as pawns.
Yeah. Just something to say that this is our land, this is Palestine. Palestine will not die. We'll go to liberate Palestine, liberate the farthest mosque. All of these is hidden under the hadith and the stories of Muhammad. They should kill all Jews.
Okay. Yeah, so no. if they would accept them, then that would be admitting defeat. And yeah. that's exactly, and that's exact, and it's a religious admonition to keep that land from falling into the hands of the Jews.
I'll tell you something maybe strange, but this is fact, happened to me. In my WhatsApp account, I have friends since days of school. Like 20 years or more than 20 years ago, we were in this WhatsApp group. And when United Arab Emirates made peace with Israel, I congratulate all of us for this peace. What happened? They attacked me and kicked me out from the WhatsApp group. Because they don't want peace. Peace for Islam now means defeat.
Defeating who? Defeating the worst of creatures.
Yeah.
So something I want to point out, John, maybe you can verify this or tell me I'm wrong, but I've heard from many of my Arabic friends in the real world that I've had over the years, mostly Iraqi and even Palestinians, actually. And they said that Arabs hate Palestinians. Because they not only did they lose their land, but they lost their land to Jews, which is astaghfirullah. That is a serious thing. But they actually really despise the Palestinian people, especially Lebanese Jordanians really despise Palestinians because of what they've done with the refugee camps and such. Can you confirm or deny or?
Yeah, even Egyptians don't love the Palestinian people, especially in Gaza, because most of them are Muslim Brotherhood. They are making trouble to Egypt every day and every night. But as I said, that's a problem. If they say there is no Palestine, Palestine is done, then Islam means that it collapses. Just you'd like to Palestine return back. Just for this religious purpose, but really most of the Arab don't like Palestinian, and I saw when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait in 1992,
August 1990.
Yeah, the Palestinian people. My father was there in Kuwait. The Palestinian people stole all the money from banks, stole even my father's money. And they hate, Palestinian also hate the Egyptians much. They were working in Kuwait. They don't love...
So you're saying that the Palestinians that were working in Kuwait at the time,
yeah,
when Saddam Hussein came in, they stole the money out of the banks?
They stole money from the banks Kuwait. They stole a lot of appliances, fridges or microwaves, whatever. All of these taken by them, and they go to Saddam Hussein, help us, give us places, give us a place to live. We will help you, and this is what happened.
Yeah, they pillaged.
Wow.
They pillaged Kuwait. I didn't know that. That's
like, no, that's interesting. Inside baseball, the Palestinians. No, so the Palestinians pillaged and plundered and then gave all the loot and booty to Saddam Hussein looking for wow, that's incredible. That's incredible. Anyway, I'm sorry.
No, all right. Let's get back on this. Okay. So it's great that we always get those insights from people that like John. I appreciate John coming to the show and sharing that with us. Okay, so let's completely understand this. When those Arabs that were living in Palestine are placed in refugee camps at the conclusion of the war for independence in Israel, the Jews across the Arab world were ethnically cleansed from those lands. I know this firsthand because I mentioned this on Saturday or Sunday. I'm sorry, that the family that my wife and I stayed with when we were in Israel, their parents were from Morocco. And they said they were told to get out of Morocco. They were only allowed to leave with the clothes that were on their back, and they were sent to Israel. They were ethnically cleansed out of all of those Arab countries. So if the Palestinians let me just say this: if the Palestinians truly want their land back, then what they're going to have to do is go to all these other countries and give those Jews their land back. This is a result. This is what happens when wars are fought. Genocides occur. This is a natural result of that. And the issue here is Egypt and Jordan, they refuse to accept those Palestinians as citizens or assimilate or accommodate them into their culture. All right, go ahead, Red.
Okay, so here's the funny thing on this, and I'm sorry. The leaders of these Arab countries, these despots at the time, now mind you, they were... they came out of the Ottoman Empire, okay? They were basically given rule and jurisdiction based on their political allegiance and stuff like that, especially to the British Empire, okay? So these were not the brightest people in the world, okay? Think about this, okay? All right. They expel all the Jews in their countries, right? Where do these Jews go? They go to Israel, thereby increasing the population density of Jews. Not only that, but they don't take in, well, they kind of do, they don't take in the Arab Palestinian population. They put them in these refugee camps, okay? I'm going to get to that in a second. But here's the funny thing. So they depopulate the Arab population and repopulate, okay, the Jewish population in Israel. You see what I'm saying? So these numbskulls, these morons, actually did the state of Israel a favor by doing this. Now you mentioned about right of return, so like, dude, I guarantee you, ain't no Jew want to go back to Jordan. Ain't no Iraq has expelled 50,000 of them. They don't want to go back to Iraq. You know, they don't want to go back to Iran. They don't want to. You know what I'm saying? They're like, oh, we're happy. We're fine. Okay, but be that as it may. Here is the sad and tragic part of this. In nowhere in the world, no refugee status, okay, has this ever been done. They created the new, well, at the time, the new UN under, it was only done once for the Palestinians and never been done again, okay, created a permanent refugee status, okay? There was no mandate to absorb the population, okay, of the refugees into the absorbing countries. There was no, dispersal or diaspora or whatever to accept them in anywhere else in the world. No, they were concentrated in these refugee camps that later became cities. If you look at these refugee camps, they're cities. They have plumbing. They have sewer systems. They have skyscrapers. They have, you know what I mean? They have all electricity. They have all, they're not tents. They have all the amenities, okay, of a city, okay? Now, true, third world city, but, you know, none the same, okay? All right. Now, think about this. They deliberately did this to keep these people as refugees. Why? because eventually, hopefully, in their mind, sometime, there's going to be a right of return for them where they can return and, guess what, overpopulate the land with the great-great-great-grandchildren, okay, of those that were dispossessed by war, the war that the Arabs started. I'm going to give you one more little fun fact of history that, that the Arabs and the Muslims don't like. This is documented in history. On the radio, in newspaper, in flyers, during 1947, right? That was what happened, 47, 48? 48. Right, okay, yeah, 48, okay. The Arabs, the Egyptians, was it Egyptians, Jordanians, Iraqis? Yeah, I think that was it. No, there was one other. But either way, they print, especially the Egyptians, broadcast on the radio. Palestinians, Arabs, flee, get out of the way of our machine guns. We are not here for booty. You can have back your land. We're just here to drive the Jews out. So they told these Palestinians in these villages to get out of their way, okay, to flee their cities, okay, and they could return after they kicked the Jews out, right? Well, they didn't kick the Jews out. So they told them to leave. They did this to them, okay? You know what I mean? Where the Jews are saying, no, no, stay, stay. We can build a community together or a nation together. And they're like, no, the other, you know, the Egyptians, the Iraqis, the Jordanians, they told us to get out of the way of their machine guns so they can kill you. So we're leaving. Yeah, that didn't work out so well for it, did it? I'm just saying. You know what I mean? So, yeah, so that's just some fun facts of history for you Muslims who are listening. But let's continue on. I'm sorry.
Nope, that's all right. Yeah, well, when we start looking at the broadcasting of that, of you know, saying get out of the way, we're going to push the Jews into the sea, and then once we push them in the sea, you can have it. They didn't count on the fact that they're going to have their butts handed to them. The fact that Israel won that war in of itself is a miracle. I mean, they had nothing. I mean, you just think they had absolutely nothing.
We imposed, the U.S. imposed a strict arms embargo on them that did not apply to the Arabs who we were selling weapons to, just to let you know.
Okay, and those Arabs are using those weapons on the Jews, and they still got beat.
You know, yes. They had to buy the weapons from Czechoslovakia. And the way, dude, there's some really great stuff on YouTube, these documentaries of the guys that were in there. These are just straight up, okay, they were World War II pilots, but these are just Jews from New York, the Bronx and stuff, you know, out of work, you know, or working, blah, 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 whatever. But they're like, hey, come and work for us and smuggling these weapons. No, it's a beautiful tale, man, of how they had to do it. And they had to fly around U.S. forces. They had to fly around the British. They were, some of them were arrested and put in jail. Okay, no, this was serious a liberation, a fight for their lives. I mean, it's a beautiful story. It really is.
Okay, let's jump back to the PowerPoint. Okay, so when we look at the Jews being ethnically cleansed from their areas, when they got to Israel, they were living in tents, folks. And we're not talking about tents for a day or two. They were living in tents for a year. They created small communities that are called like kibbutzes. And in these kibbutzes, the conditions were just horrendous. And they carved out of that land what is now Israel. They immediately started planting trees. They started irrigating land. And it's like Israel supplies more fruit, exports more fruit to Europe than any other country on the planet.
Yeah,
that's how much work they've done there. But
let's blockade all of Israel. What do they call it? The PSD moment or whatever.
BDS. What, we're getting to that.
BDS. Okay. We don't want fruit. No.
All right. Okay. And then, of course, Egypt, Jordan, they refuse to accept the Palestinians' right of return. And this is what Israel looked like right after that war. These are the armistice lines in 1949 after the war from independence. So you notice that there isn't a lot of it's more streamlined. This sector right here is wider, is more defensible. And this area right here, of course, shrinks significantly. And this, of course, is cordoned off. And as far as the Gaza Strip is concerned. All right, let's move to the next one. All right, 1964, the PLO is established. The Palestinian Liberal Organization by this it was actually created by Egypt. This is up right up your alley, John, by this guy here, Yasser Arafat. Now, Yasser Arafat, his mentor was the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Amin al-Husseini. So this guy is influenced by al-Husseini. Well, who was al-Husseini? Al-Husseini is the one that says, Arabs, rise, one man, and fight for your sacred rights. Kill the Jews wherever you find them. This pleases God, don't you see? This saves your honor. God is with you. Now, who was al-Husseini? Well, he was Hitler's pal. You know, Hitler, the guy that just stuck 6 million of them into ovens in Poland. Yeah, that guy. So when you start looking at a correlation between Nazism and this desire to remove Jews from their Holy Land, you don't need to look any further than this. And the fact that they gave that Arafat a Nobel Peace Prize is just beyond unforgivable. I mean, you just don't get away with that. All right, so let's look at the 67-day war. Now, in the 67-day war, you have Egypt massing soldiers, armor along the border with Israel, threatening Israel. Israel has to shut down the entire country. You have threats from Syria up here in the Golan Heights. You have threats from Jordan here within the West Bank. But the main concern, of course, is Egypt. So what does Israel do? They shut down the Straits of Tehran down here and the Suez Canal, which shut down the shipping going through there. So that was one of the main concerns internationally anyway. And then it, of course, occupies Sinai. Okay, I just said that. And then what Israel does in response to this, instead of waiting for Egypt to launch the offensive on their terms, Israel launches a surprise attack on the Egyptian Air Force and destroys the entire Egyptian Air Force in 2 hours while they're still on the ground. And if you read the details behind that, it just happened to coincide with what you would call a shift change, where there was no communication going on between the people that are coming on the shift and the people leaving the shift. So it just happened to happen just right at the right time. Kind of comical. Anyway, so Egypt, and then plus on top of that, Egypt's armor is subsequently destroyed in place in the Sinai. And then you have Syrians attacking out of the Golan Heights, and they're turned back. And then Israel is practically begging Jordan to stay out of it because it's not going to do them the good. And Jordan, of course, not wanting to listen to the Jews themselves, they decide to attack too. So when you look at all of these attacks, they're repelled through Israeli air superiority, and the Arab armies are forced to, again, sign another treaty, another armistice in disgrace. Now,
can I add some color commentary on that?
Go ahead.
Okay. So there are recordings. There are NSA, CIA recordings. I forgot which one got them. Where what's his name? The dude from Egypt is talking to the dude to Syria. Nasser is talking to what's his name in Syria. Okay, now each of them have lied to each other. Okay. Seriously, because they actually had a plan for this, and actually the Jordanians also were part of the plan, but all of them have been lying to each other. Well, now the jig is up, and they're trying to get the Jordanians involved, right? Okay? And they're talking to each other. And what do they say? They say, we'll just blame the Americans. I am not making this up. We'll blame the Americans' interference. They're like, oh, that's brilliant for our losses. Okay, blah, blah, blah. But no, the whole thing, they're lying to each other. Okay? Completely and totally. They're saying, because no, Egypt was supposed to advance so far. Egypt said, we are advancing so far. But no, they were getting destroyed. Syria was supposed to advance so far. That was going to trigger the Egyptian advancement, which they actually did. Okay? But then they got slaughtered. Okay, you know what I mean? Okay, so they're completely lying to each other. Here's another fun fact. You got to look this up. There was this Jewish spy who actually infiltrated the highest ranks of the Syrian military. And he planted on the Golan Heights. Maybe this is not 1967 war. No, you know, that's the next war. We'll get to
73,
that.
73, Yom Kippur.
Yeah, 73, yeah. That's a fun story. But anyway, I just wanted to point this out. They lied to each other, created this whole mess, and what did they say? We're going to blame the Americans.
Well, they have Gabel Nasser at that time called, I'm not sure if Brezhnev was in office at that time, or which Russian prime minister was in charge at that time, but he called him begging to get the Russians to come to their aid. And he was like, dude, no, we've given you, sold you all of this equipment, all of this armor, all of these airplanes, and you've squandered it.
Oh, yeah, that's what it was. They sold them the high-tech tank busters, I think it was. Okay.
Well, no, they sold them all of their armor, of their aircraft. Egypt couldn't build anything. They weren't building anything in Egypt. It was the Russians that were selling it to them.
But they sold them this weapon system that had this, you know, radius, kill radius. But they had to advance the weapon system with the army. Well, they didn't do that. They advanced the army because the Syrians were pushing them to. So they advanced the army outside of this kill radius of this weapon system that was destroying armor. Okay? And then forget about the Israelis. No, it wasn't. I'm sorry. It wasn't armor. It was anti-aircraft. And they advanced their armor outside of the protection, okay, of the kill radius, okay, of these surface-to-air missiles. And once they did that, that's when the Israelis just pounded the armor and they were able to take them out. Yeah. Interesting story.
Yeah, it's kind of like the what they call it, the highway of death, when Saddam was trying to make a withdrawal from Kuwait. Pretty ugly stuff. Okay, so let's look at the results of the Six-Day War. Notice, at the beginning of the Six-Day War, the possessions of Israel right here, this is controlled by Jordan, this is controlled, this is the Gaza Strip anyway, and this is what's controlled, and this is controlled by Syria. But notice, and I also want to, as an aside here, I'll tell you that these Golan Heights, the Syrians used to sit up in the Golan Heights and shoot down at kibbutzes right on the Sea of Galilee. I had a personal conversation with the guy whose parents were one of the original occupants up there, and they had a kibbutz right up here in the Sea of Galilee, and they would have to hide at a certain time during the day because the Syrians would start shooting into their kibbutz, shooting at people to terrorize them. So this terrorization of Israel from strategic location, these Golan Heights, I mean, they're really high hills. Let's just put it that way. Well, they're mountains, but it looks right down along this on the east side of the Sea of Galilee. All right, I digress. But look at how much land now Israel possesses after this war. They have the Sinai, they have the Golan Heights, and of course they took East Jerusalem, they've taken control of the Temple Mount, and they have the West Bank itself. But then the Arabs, they get together, they start colluding, and it comes up with the Karatem Resolution. And this is where they all get together, and you have the three no's. Here are the three no's. They're not going to have any peace with Israel, they're not going to have any recognition of Israel, and they're not going to have any negotiations with Israel. And this eventually leads to the Yom Kippur War in 1973. Now, if you look at the attempts for peace, the Camp David And here's the thing that we need to understand. I'm not sure when I cover this, but the Camp David Accords returned the Sinai Peninsula to Egypt. And here's why. This is what I'm going to take this off. I just want to make sure people understand this. The reason why Israel, from a legal perspective, from the laws of international warfare, from an international position, they were required to return the Sinai to Egypt. And the reason is that if you take land in a war in which you initiated, you are not internationally entitled and recognized internationally as being entitled to that land. Now, you notice that Israel, at the beginning of the war, did launch a preemptive attack on the Egyptian Air Force Well, why? Because Egypt had amassed all their armor up on this, on the Israeli border. They were going to attack. So instead of waiting for the Egyptians to attack them, Israel took out their aircraft or their air ability in 2 hours. So therefore, since they attacked Egypt first, they were not legally allowed to keep it. So they negotiated with Anwar Sadat, and that didn't end well for Anwar Sadat, oh, by the way, the Camp David Accords, and Jimmy Carter, of all people in the world. And then you have the Oslo Accords in 1993, and this is where you have Billy Clinton and Menachem Begin and Yasser Arafat. And then you have the second Intifada in 2000, where they start the other uprisings. And look at here. In 2005, Ariel Sharon returns the Gaza Strip to the Palestinians, gives them complete autonomy over of that land, turning over buildings and businesses. They destroyed everything. And what do? They elect Hamas. They elect a terrorist organizations to rule their country. And what happens? They start sending rockets into Israel almost immediately after this. And if you look at a recent volley of rockets coming out of the Gaza Strip, here you have 690 rockets, and this isn't even covering last year's what we did last year. And now let's look at the condemnation of the UN on Israel from 1993 to 2013. What do we have? Or no, let's back up here. It's 1955 to 1992. You have the number of resolutions against Israel. You got five calls on Israel to refrain from holding military parade. Israel deplores Israel military parade, censures Israel for administrative acts to change the status of Jerusalem. You're up to 22 deplores Israel, condemns Israel. 41 here censures Israel in the strongest terms, Jerusalem as its basic law, reiterates Israel's claim to Jerusalem are null and void. Strongly condemns Israel vigorously for defending themselves when they're bombed. My gosh. We're up to 62 here. Condemns Israel for violence against Palestinians at Haram al-Sharif Temple Mount. Oh, my gosh. They're rioting, but Israel, when they try to protect themselves, they're condemned for it. Israel defied U.S. deporting Palestinian civilians. They're condemned for that. These people that are attacking them, they're condemned for that. Calls for the safety and protection of Palestinian cities. Calls for withdrawal of Israel troops from Palestinian cities, including Ramallah. Emphasizes urgency. So you have 76 resolutions against Israel. One country in the UN.
Do you mind if I say one thing? I feel that this is so sad. This is not going to bring peace. The United Nations should be bringing peace and conflict to
idiotic.
Because the thing is, you could say I care about Palestinians, which is extremely valid and fair and kind and compassionate, but we need to care about Israelis too. They both matter. And that's an issue. It's not validating Israeli people, so they should be validated.
It gets worse here, Issa. Because so look at here. You have 76 resolutions against one country by the UN. But let's look at the resolutions against the Palestinians. How many do you have? One. One resolution against attacks by Palestinians against Israeli citizens. One. One resolution. And look what it says. It calls on the Palestinian Authority to meet its express commitment to ensure that those responsible for terrorist acts are brought to justice. Those responsible for terrorist attacks brought to justice by the Palestinians. Are they brought to justice? No.
No, they're given streets named after them, schools named after them. They're martyrs.
I got it right here, Red. I got this right here. Pay to slay. So when you look at Palestinian payments to the families of those people who do kill Israelis and die in the process, here's what they get. You get 6,000 shekels immediately, $1,700. And in the Gaza Strip, that's a lot of money, folks. You get 1,400 shekels a month for life. And then the wife gets 114 per child, $57. If you're in Jerusalem, you get 86. You know, look at
their We're paying for that. We're right. actually paying for that.
Yeah. Exactly. When we send money to what's the what do they call now? Not Hamas. We send it to the Palestinian Authority. We send it to PA. This is where the money's going. This is where your tax dollars are going. They're paying these people to kill Israelis. On top of that, look at this. When you look at people who are thrown in jail for terrorist activity or planning terrorist attacks or committing crimes against Israelis, they're paying these people and their families money for every month that they're in jail. This is absolutely sick. What's going on there? Look at the number of UN resolutions in 2018. 2018, you had 20 resolutions against Israel. 21. Iran had one resolution by the UN against it. Iran, you know, the guys that want to make a nuclear bomb and bomb Israel. North Korea, the despotic kingdom itself, where if you even dare to have any religion of any kind, you're thrown in the gulag. Russia, yeah, Russia gets one. The United States even got dinged that year. I can't even remember what it was for, but you know, yeah, we got a resolution passed against us.
Probably for George Floyd.
Yeah, this is 2018. No, George Floyd is 2020. Hamas, zero. You're launching rockets into Israel. No condemnation. No, no, no. China, none. Turkey, Erdogan, none. Iraq, none. Venezuela, yeah, none. What about last year? Let's look at last year. Last year, Israel had 14 resolutions passed against it, condemning it. Iran, yeah, we're still building that nuclear bomb. They get one. North Korea, one. Russia, only because they invaded the Crimea, they get one. Myanmar, they get one only because they had a military coup and killed like 800 people and imprisoned, you know, thousands of people. That's the only reason why they got condemned. Syria, which is a humanitarian crisis, gets zero. Hamas, who launches a whole bunch of rockets into Israel last May, none. China, you know, they're ethnically cleansing.
They're committing a genocide, which the NBA supports.
Exactly, yeah. Right. Yeah, with the Uyghurs, they don't even get condemned. Turkey, no, of course. Nigeria, where you have a Christian genocide going on. Nope, not a word, not boo. Venezuela, zero. So when we start
we didn't get one. We didn't get one for George Floyd. Come on.
No. Look at these attacks. Over 4,000 rockets are fired from Gaza last May. And a lot of them, unfortunately, a lot of them didn't even make it to Israel because these guys have, well, number one, if you watch recent debates, people are historical illiterates. And obviously they're engineering illiterates also. That's what drives them. Anyway, so when Israel responds, Israel's condemned for having rockets shot at it. Israel's condemned when these rockets are launched at it. And you think about this. Israel uses its rockets to protect its people. The Palestinians use their people to protect their rockets.
And the imam's okay with that.
Yes. That's exactly right. Yeah, they have a right to defend themselves. Defend themselves from what? They didn't start it, for crying out loud. Anyway, I don't know if this is Golda Meir said this. We can forgive the Arabs for killing our children. We cannot forgive them for forcing us to kill their children. And we only have peace with the Arabs when they love their children as much as they hate us. Then we have the BDS movement going on today. The BDS boycott, divest, and sanction. Destroy Israel through economic means. Now look at this.
The Democratic Party is almost officially adopted that. No, they will.
Oh, yes.
By the next convention, they will officially adopt this as their platform. I guarantee. Guaranteed. The progressives have totally taken over. The socialists have totally taken over because the old guard of the Democratic Party are all senile. You got Nancy Pelosi. She's retiring. You got Chuck Schumer. He doesn't care. You got, Nadler. He's brain dead. The entire old guard of the Democratic Party is gone. Okay, the watchdogs, what you would say, okay, of the Democratic Party that offers any semblance, any sanity,
Okay, even Steny Hoyer's lost his mind. Yeah, I mean, no, I used to think he was kind of a voice of reason. Yeah,
he's, no, he's you only have you have Manchin, okay, a Democrat from Virginia, from West Virginia, and you've got the bisexual. No stuff. She says, I'm a bisexual swinging Democrat, but I'm against this crap that they're pushing on us. How long can these two hold out? Do you see what I'm saying? Okay, not very long. Okay, well,
let's hope they hold out until November of 2022. Is it election this year? Yeah, the election is this year. Come think about it.
Yeah, it is.
Hold
out
till November. Yeah,
they will. Schumer is going to push the filibuster thing, which he actually implemented. He created the filibuster of 60 votes. Okay. Seriously, he's the one who created it. The filibuster has been around for a long time. Schumer actually created the 60 votes, okay, for the filibuster. He actually reduced it. Okay, there's a long history to this filibuster. Well, okay, so no, the filibuster used to have to sit there and speak, right? Well, they said, we don't want to speak, so let's just have 60 votes. You know what I mean? That was Schumer who implemented this.
Well, it was to cut off debate is what the 60 vote.
Right. He reduced it. Yeah, whatever it was, this was Schumer's idea, okay? All right? But now he's going against it, okay?
Can I interject one quick thing?
Sure.
I wanted to talk about BDS a little bit. I understand that people feel traumatized. There is pain and suffering that people feel, and we should validate that. However, is BDS a way of validating people's pain and suffering? Can we actually have dialogue when you're just condemning one side of the group, of the conflict? You can't actually have a real conversation if you're just saying, I'm going to boycott you, I'm going to divest and sanction you, without actually hearing your point of view. There's a really great presenter, his name's Rudy Rockman, and he goes around and he interviews people about Israel. He asks people about Israel, and some people are like, Israel's the worst place ever. And then he's very kind and compassionate. He's like, well, why do you think Israel is bad? All these claims and stories about Israel, a lot of them are not true. It's just bad publicity that Israel gets. And it's not a fair conversation that we're having in this space. We can validate Palestinian suffering without throwing Israel and Israelis under the bus. I think that's important. And if you don't like some of the politicians there, that's fine. Some people don't like politicians here, but this is a part of democracy. We're allowed to not like our politicians. You know, we're allowed to have dissent. And that's the important thing. We should have dissent if we disagree. We don't have to have violence, but we can have verbal, open dissent to things that we don't agree with. And that's good.
I want to ask you a question.
Sure.
I want to ask you a question. I'm going to throw up this next slide up on the screen. Okay, here's the guy that founded the BDS movement.
Yes.
Omar Baghdadi.
Yes.
They oppose the Jewish state in any part of Palestine. No Palestinian will ever accept a Jewish state in Palestine. So where does the conversation begin with a guy like that?
Well, you know, I think it's interesting. I'm not sure if this is the same man, but I think it is the same guy, because I did a Israel training course. Like, I learned all about this situation, so I know what I'm talking about when I'm talking about it. It's a great organization called Field for Truth. Very great organization to learn more about Israel and the understanding of what's going on. And it's very objective and fair and honest, I think. I think that's the same man who actually got education in Israel.
I think he's an Arab Israeli citizen
or a Palestinian citizen of Israel. And he's gotten actual services from Israel. And that's the perfect example. I'm like, did you not, if this is the same person, I'm not exactly sure. I forget the person exactly, but I think it's the same person. Didn't you get education in Israel, regardless of your ethnicity? Israel does not discriminate based on your religion, your ethnicity. And in fact, it actually follows a Muslim thing from the greatest empire of Islam, like the greatest element for the empire of Islam, which is the Ottoman Empire, which is the millet system. And it's no Muslim country is even using the millet system now, where they actually have people from different cultures and religions going into their own spaces and being respectful of that.
Of course.
So it's pretty amazing. And nobody wants to talk about that. They say, oh, it's horrible second-class citizenship that's going on there. And I would say, I don't think so. You might use the look at Gaza and the West Bank. That's a more complex situation that's nuanced and needs to be dealt with, and with a fair, objective lens, not just screaming and yelling.
Well, you say we have. How do you deal with Gaza? I mean,
so the thing is,
to be honest here, if with Gaza, they allow them to have free, fair, open elections.
Yes,
and they elect Hamas to rule them.
Right.
So what do you do now? Do we have to go in there and remove the governmental system that they elected for themselves and say no, start over? What do you do with something like that? Same thing with the West Bank, with Fatah. You know, the bottom line is that these entities that Israel is being forced to deal with don't want to negotiate with Israel. They want no part of a two-state solution. They want the Jews gone. The entirety yes. of that land, according to them, belongs to them, and any Jew squatting on that land is unacceptable. So when this guy says they will not accept a Jewish state, they're not just saying they're not going to accept Israel as a state. They're saying they're not going to accept any Jews in Israel, period.
Right.
So,
just murder.
So the question is, where do you begin a dialogue with somebody like that?
Well, I think
their sole purpose and purposes of life is your destruction, your death.
I think why people hate is because people have ignorance. I think that there's groups like Seeds for Peace, which allow for Jews and Palestinians, Israelis and Palestinians to come together. And it's not perfect, but it's a start. We need to.
And where did they come together at? What land are they coming together at?
Sometimes in America. It depends. There are certain places, spaces.
But not in Gaza, right? Not in Gaza. See, that's the point that Eric is showing. See, that's the point that Eric is
showing. I showed a video last week of a Jew, a family of Jews, a family or maybe just two of them, made a wrong turn and ended up in the Gaza Strip.
And didn't end well for them.
Yeah, they were beaten. Their car set on fire, and essentially had to send the IDF in there to rescue them, get them out of there. And they just by accident, Jews are here. And this is the reaction. This is the visceral hatred that exists in that region.
Okay. I do have to stand up for the Palestinians. Okay, in one aspect, you can go and Google this. It's called Ubadiah Street. Just YouTube it, Ubadiah Street. Okay, this is in Hebron. Okay, there is this small Jewish clan that took over this hotel. Supposedly they bought it, although they have no evidence that they bought this hotel. But either way, they occupied it. This is going back to the 1950s. They occupied this hotel, and they brought in, family, blah, 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 over the years. But anyway, they occupy this entire street. It's called Ubadiah Street, okay? And this is in Palestinian-controlled territory, supposedly, allegedly, in the West Bank. Well, Palestinians cannot walk down the street, but they can't walk down the street for their own safety. Why? Because Ubadiah Street, it's in a mountainous region. So Ubadiah Street is on the top, okay? And the streets underneath are lower. Because why? Because these Jewish kids, okay, of this strict ultra-Orthodox, Chabadniks, okay, that don't join the military, don't join the army, whatever, okay, they throw rocks at the Palestinians when they're just going to shop in the local shop, shopping area. Okay, this is all documented. So now they're forbidden from walking. Not only that, but the Israelis, okay, they have the Israeli army where they are assigned. There's an Israeli contingent army that is assigned to guard this small clan. I think they only occupy, I think they're only probably not even 100 at the most. Okay, I think they're around 50. Anyway, when they go out to the Palestinian to the Palestinian markets, they've got to close everything down. Okay, and these soldiers, one soldier per one Israeli soldier per Jewish settler, if you want to call it that, or occupier of Ubadiah Street, one soldier per person. It's no joke. Think about the logistics of that. Guards, okay, the people that are going to shop, okay, or just walking down the street. They got videos where there's this soldier, okay, guarding this old woman walking on the street, okay, in Hebron, okay, where she is totally in, just insulting every Palestinian she sees, spitting on them. You know what I mean? But as soon as the Palestinian speaks up and says, hey, you're spitting on me, you old bat? Okay, no. Okay, that's when the Israeli soldier comes in and says, no, stop this, continue on. You know what I mean? So, no, what I am saying is this, on that part, on that aspect, they are sowing the seeds of their own destruction, okay? But I don't know why Israel will tear up other settlements, but these numbskulls, they protect them. And I'm sorry, it's a waste of resources, and it's just stupid. Go on YouTube, Hubadiah Street, and you're going to be like, are you freaking kidding me? You know what I mean? Go check it out.
Interesting. Yeah, I posted in chat there a link to a YouTube channel. It's called the Israel Guys. And these are two Americans that they're over in Israel. And what they do is they report on current events there in Israel. And it's really a good, it's really an informative show. So if you ever get a chance to get over there.
By the way, a lot of the videos of Hubadiah Street, they're pro the Jews of Hubadiah. So this isn't like these are, you know, anti-Semite. Okay. You know what I mean? Okay. No, they're like promoting this. Like, this is what we're doing. They're proud of it. I'm just saying, no, Hubadiah Street, go and Google it. It's stupid. It really is just stupid. Okay. Mm.
It sounds to me like it ain't very intelligent, that's for sure. All right, let's finish this Hamajama up. Okay, so the BDS movement did not start with this guy right here. The BDS movement started basically in 1935 and 38. But it does continue today. And here are some examples of this. Like I said, I'm not going to sit here and belabor the point of going through all these things of what the Nazis did to the Jews as far as boycotting them and compare that to what the BDS movement does, but it's essentially the same thing. So whatever the Nazis did to the Jews, the BDS movement has essentially duplicated. All right, so let's make a conclusion here. Number one, all attempts for peace by Israel have either failed or have been rejected or have failed. It was obvious in Ariel Sharon's attempt with the Land for Peace and giving back the Gaza Strip to the Palestinians. That did not work. That did not work out well for the Israelis at all. Why? Because just as soon as it was given back, they tore everything up, destroyed everything that was Jewish there, and then they started launching rockets and terrorist attacks against the Jews. We also looked at Israel having a biblically mandated right to the land. According to the Bible, the covenant was made with Abraham. It was passed to Isaac, not Ishmael. Then it was given to Jacob. Jacob's 12 tribes, and then passed the Mosaic Covenant, and then that Mosaic Covenant continued. It had nothing to do with Israel or with Ishmael. And then the legal right to their land, I showed you that Israel actually has a legal right to the West Bank. Why? Jordan attacked Israel from that land. It has a legal right to the Gaza Strip. Why? Syria attacked Israel from that land. You lost. There are consequences to wars. You attack somebody and you lose. Don't go sniveling to anybody else about losing the land that you attacked your opponent from. Period. And the Bible tells us that we pay for the peace of Jerusalem. Okay. So we recognize the Jewish state, Jerusalem, as being the undivided, now we do anyway, as being the undivided capital of Israel. And because we finally moved our embassy there, something that had been done or been trying to get done since 1992.
Who did that? Who did that? Donald Trump.
The Trumpster did that. All right. So, boy, that's right at an hour and a half. I'm getting gooder at this job. Okay.
Oh, let me just add one thing because I do want to comment on this.
I'm going to go around the horn. So you okay, go ahead okay. and start. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll start. Okay, so you're bringing up Adolf, you brought up Adolf and the boys early on. Okay. I just want you to let you know, you can go and get this book. I haven't got it yet, but I've read excerpts of it. It's Goebbels' diaries, okay? They have been translated. Well, some of them have been translated, okay? All right? No, here's the funny thing. Goebbels and all the others, and Adolf Hitler was in response to this. Well, he was having a positive response to this. He was going to resettle all the Jews in Europe, resettle them in Israel. This is no joke. They were seriously considering it. Goebbels was a promoter of this. So was Goring. They were promoting this. But what happened? Well, he sent that refugee boat, okay, all over the world, and then America sent it back. And then Adolf Hitler, according to Goebbels, in his diaries, said, everyone wants me to do this. It's no joke. This is according to Goebbels. Okay, in his diaries, they were going to resettle the Jews in Israel. Hmm. But because of everybody sent this boat of refugees back to Germany to be killed, to be exterminated.
They weren't killing them fast enough.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Okay, I mean, they were literally going to resettle them in Palestine. And there's also other things, too. The Germans needed the Arab oil, et cetera, et cetera. You know what I mean? But no, that was what they were planning on doing. But unfortunately, because, you know, just let you know. But anyway, definitely Google Obadiah Street. I'll send you links, Eric. So when you watch it, you're going to be like, are you freaking kidding me? You know, I'm just sorry. I mean, yeah. Anyway. All right. I'm off.
All righty. Let's jump over to John. John, did you have anything that you wanted to add tonight?
No.
Okay, well, I really appreciate you coming on tonight and helping us out with a couple of those details that we might have missed. All right, Connie? Islam equals death, lady? She might have stepped away. Issa, you have anything? Issa appears to have stepped away. Paul?
I think that if you're a parent and you're listening to this, get your children, make them sit down and watch this entire thing. You know, and I would actually go to the point where I would test them on it, to the point where they have to know this because their local schools will not teach this. That's important to understand. Your local schools will not teach your children what was just shown to you. Thank you, Eric. Well done.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that. All right. Okay, well, we're going to call it a night. Darcy commented here saying that I'm sounding gooder. I'm feeling gooder-er, not the goodest. I'm still having gosh. Avoid the vid. I have to say it, avoid the vid. It just makes you feel miserable. But I am feeling much better than I was on Sunday, that's for sure. Okay, we're going to call it a night. Thank you, everybody that came here in the panel, contributed. Oh, a couple admin things. I just got a message from Skype. Our brother, Dr. Kubar Phobia, is going to be debating Abbas on the 29th of January, which date would... Why didn't I passed over you, Dr. Kufar. I'm sorry. Did you have anything that you wanted to add to this? I didn't.
Oh, that's okay. No, I just wanted to say it was an excellent show, and I agree with what Paul said. You got to teach your kids because this is not something that they're going to teach in school. And yes, me and Abbas, we have agreed 1 p.m. Not this Saturday because he's busy, the following Saturday.
Okay, that's a Saturday. Okay, good, good. And let's see here. I was going to ask, is that a moderated debate or is that just going to be a conversation or what? Or?
Well, I was hoping that we could do it on your show, if possible. If not, I'll do it on mine. And I guess we could have a moderated.
Well, we could do it on mine, but you don't have 4 hours.
No, I don't think I want to debate 4 hours.
All right, okay. Well, yeah, if you want to do it, let me know and we'll get the logistics of it. We'll get the logistics of it set up. That's perfectly fine by me. Yeah, I'd love to hear that. Anyway, we've heard all the majority of the arguments for Muhammad in the Bible. Also, Chris Claus has assured me that he is going to be having a show this Thursday evening at, I think it was 8 p.m. Eastern time. So it'll be right at the end of Paul's show. What?
Where is Chris? He's kind of like been MIA for a while.
Well,
he's working a different shift.
Yeah, he got
Tommy's going off to Cuba too, man.
I know. What he's doing, I think he said he was leaving Friday or Saturday. I mean,
he said Friday.
Yeah, okay, so he's going to.
But by the way, just a correction. It's in Hebron, and it's Romala Street or King David Street. Shuda Street, King David Street in Hebron. I'll send you the links to the videos. No, you're gonna be like, seriously, you watch these, you're gonna be like, are you freaking kidding me? No, kill that old bat. I'm just saying. Any old bat spits on me. No, I'm sorry. I'm just saying. I'm tired of that.
Okay, Windhill. I don't know. I want to debate you on this topic of this show, whether or not Israel, the Jews have a right to the land. Okay.
That's kind of silly because you just proved using historical documents and stuff.
So well, he says, no,
silly
he said,
silly debate.
He says, my sheets won't help me. I don't know what he means by my sheets or not sheets. Helping me. My
history PowerPoint. Won't help you.
Well, I mean, that send me an email. And we'll work something out. Mods in the chat. Everybody in the chat, thank you for coming today and enduring this. I saw there's a lot. Of course, there's always you guys are always really active in there, and I try to keep up. But at the same time, when I'm trying to read what you're saying here and listening, I'm not a good multitasker, obviously. But I do appreciate y'all coming and spending your Tuesday evening with me, especially when the Shimonian was on tonight. So God bless you, and we will see you on Sunday here in the Cross of the Crescent Discussion Group. God bless.
God bless.